Welcome back to the program. The fact is that art theft is one of the most profitable criminal enterprises in the world. Each year, the world sees over $6 billion in losses to galleries and art collectors. Just last May, five paintings worth over $125 million in total were stolen from the Paris Museum of Modern Art and still have not been recovered. We're going to talk about this world of art theft today with two distinguished journalists. We're joined by Anthony Amore. He's a columnist with the Boston Herald and head of security at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum since 2005. And Tom Moshberg, he's an award-winning investigative reporter and the Sunday editor for the Boston Herald. It is my pleasure to welcome Anthony and Tom both to talk about their book, Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. Anthony, Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Anthony, start with you. Why is art theft such a seemingly a growing crime when it seems like it would be so hard, arguably, to get rid of these paintings?
Well, that's a great question. I think that art theft is just getting more attention lately. I don't think it's actually growing. It's been going on since art has been in existence in its earliest days. And I think in the last, say, 4 or 5 years, there's been more attention paid to the problem. And thefts like the one you described a year ago, May, at the Paris Museum of Art, really bring it a lot of attention, bring it to the front pages of the papers.
It does seem that it would be so difficult, though, to unload these paintings, Tom.
Well, yeah, that's the great predicament. And what we write about in the book is that these thieves are often very unschooled, and they're kind of run-of-the-mill thugs who are really more like break-in artists than art aficionados. So they do the equivalent of a kidnapping. They art-nap a famous painting, imagining that they can immediately cash it in somewhere on the black market, only to discover that it's impossible to sell, and it just sort of they end up trying to get it, sell it back or ransom it back to the museum or to the police. And there are several instances where they just give up and drop it off in a public place and call law enforcement and say, why don't you come pick it up?
Are there situations, either one of you, situations where private collectors have essentially arranged for the theft of a painting?
There are situations like that, sure. There, one of the things that the book, Stealing Rembrandts, shows is that the way paintings are stolen are myriad. I mean, there's so many different scenarios in which they're taken, that it really begged the book. That's one of the impetuses of the book to get into the different scenarios. It's not what you see on television or in the movies. It's totally different.
Talk a little bit about the process of these thefts themselves, because most of these museums, you would think, and certainly most of us have had the experience of being in a lot of these museums, are pretty well secured. Tom?
Well, yeah, yes and no. The main problem museums face, of course, is that they want the art to be as accessible as possible. When you go to a museum, you don't want to have a lot of armed guards around and whistling alarms and a sense of, you know, like you're in a jewelry store or, you know, in a bank where everything is security-minded. What you want is to be able to commune with the paintings as closely as possible. And so you have this very fine line between accessibility and vulnerability. And given the fact that a lot of art thieves simply snatch a painting from a wall, or in some cases a couple of them get together and storm into a museum with firearms, there's really not a lot that a museum can do in that situation. I mean, their guards aren't armed, and they, you know, people just have to scatter and let them, you know, rush in and rush out.
Anthony, why aren't their guards armed? I mean, certainly there are a lot of cameras in there. There are a lot of other security devices. Certainly the potential technologically exists today.
Well, there are some museums, very few, that have armed guards. But think about your experience at a museum. It's all about the aesthetic, about beauty, about enjoying and taking your time and having access to the best that man has ever produced. And to have somebody standing ominously by you with a sidearm watching you just kind of, I think, takes away from that experience. It's more, I think, pleasing to have maybe an unarmed guard who appears to be like a docent or what have you. And then to balance that lessened security with technology throughout the building.
Are most of these thefts and the ones you detail in the book, have most of them taken place while the museum has actually been open with people in there, or are these thieves that come in after hours?
Well, it happens in all those ways. In stealing Rembrandts, we describe many different scenarios, and all of these are fairly common. There's the armed blitz. There's the somebody sneaking in and just grabbing a painting and running out, as you may have heard happen with a Picasso in San Francisco not long ago. And then you have a lot of very clever break-in artists, and they're able to break a lock in the back, as happened at the Paris Museum, or cut a panel through a door, or in some cases they might actually do something as acrobatic as lowering themselves down a rope through a skylight.
Anthony, talk a little bit about the paintings that have been the most stolen. Really, it appears that Rembrandts really win the prize, hands down.
They do. Picasso's have been stolen incredibly frequently, too. But the favorite piece that Tom and I like to talk about is the Portrait of Jacob de Gein by Rembrandt, which is the most often stolen painting in the world. It's called the Takeaway Rembrandt, and it was stolen from the Dulwich Picture Gallery in London 4 times. And it really is a great illustration of art theft because the reasons and the methods used to steal it each time are different. For instance, one of the thefts was a thin guy described as rubber-boned by the police. He climbed to a very small panel he cut into a side door at the gallery. And then the next time it was stolen was just I guess the British would call him a nutter, someone who walked in and just removed it from the wall and calmly walked out, put it on his bicycle, and rode away. The police caught him a few minutes later. He said he just wanted to take it home and sketch it. And then other thefts were through skylights and the rest. So you really get a good picture of, you know, this one anecdote about Rembrandt and that one painting really gives you an idea of the different ways this is done and why.
Why this painting? Why Rembrandt in general and this particular painting specifically?
Well, what we discovered is that even the least educated criminal, somebody who's accustomed to just armed robberies at convenience stores, recognizes the name Rembrandt, since it's such an important historical name. And so they figure, well, I'll take the Rembrandt. That's got to be worth the most. So it's a really simple calculation for them. Of course, they don't really know about art. They don't know how to care for art properly. I mean, we have numerous instances where once they get a hold of the painting, it winds up in very unpleasant places like a pig farm in Rhode Island or the trunk of a car or the back of a saloon in Cincinnati. So, you know, you're talking about very unschooled people who who just want to get something with a famous name attached to
mm-hmm.
it.
Are there questions, when these paintings are stolen and then returned or recovered in some way, are there questions that arise with respect to the provenance of that painting because it's been out of somebody's control for a period of time?
Well, it's on the one hand, I would say yes, because anytime you have a Rembrandt, it's famous for the misattribution. At the beginning of the century, there were, or before, there were thought to be 2,000 Rembrandts in the United States, and after much examination that's still ongoing, the number has dropped dramatically. But in terms of when a painting is stolen and then recovered or returned, the methods used to identify whether that was the original painting stolen are very reliable.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically infallible, actually. It's really easy to identify the item that was taken.
And is this a more recent phenomenon because of technology, or has it always been, to the trained eye, relatively easy to determine that?
Well, I think it's been relatively easy because one of the things that you look for, a great sign, is even when somebody calls and says they have your painting, is to ask them, well, what's on the back of the painting? And very, very few people can tell you what's on the back of a particular painting. Even a conservator who may have worked on the painting at one time can't reliably say a year or so later what was on the back and exactly how it's situated, but the museum would know. So that's one of the methods. But then there are great scientific methods to instantly mm-hmm. identify a paint chip. It's almost like the painting's DNA,
right.
The cracking pattern on a painting, which cannot be replicated by anyone. It's like the fingerprint of a painting. So it's quite easy and a very reliable method.
Mm-hmm.
What's tricky, of course, is determining whether the painting was done by Rembrandt or by one of his best students or acolytes, and a lot of confusion arises as a result of that. But even paintings by the School of Rembrandt artist, the men in his studio, are extremely valuable, just not as valuable as Rembrandt's own paintings.
As this whole area of art theft has gotten more attention, as we talked about at the outset, has there evolved a group of people, underground collectors, that are potential buyers for these?
When you talk about a masterpiece like a Rembrandt or a Picasso or Vermeer, of course, they're never sold. And there are no instances in which they're stolen and then sold on a black market that we could identify, at least not in the last 100 years. But when you talk about smaller pieces, less identifiable artists, or especially when you talk about objects like ancient vases or things that aren't one of a kind, then you see where maybe it's easier to sell. When we talk about stealing art being a fool's errand, we're talking primarily about masterworks. The recovery rate for smaller pieces is much, much lower than for a masterpiece.
And what is the recovery rate for masterpieces? I mean, you talk about this theft at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum that still is unsolved.
Well, the recovery rate is a number that's hard to put an exact metric to because of the number of art thefts that are unreported, even amongst masterpieces, and because oftentimes the recovery is something that's kept very quiet as a condition of the recovery. So it's hard to say, but estimates are over 50-60% for masterpieces. For lesser pieces, it's much lower. But I would add, you mentioned the Gardner Museum theft, which I'm investigating. Mm-hmm. I would say that I have a very strong belief, and I always have, that will before long be chalked up to a solved case rather than an open case.
Explain what you mean by that.
I just feel that we're working every day incredibly hard to recover these paintings in tandem with the FBI and the Justice Department, where it's a very, very active investigation. I'm very pleased with the progress we've made over the years, and I'm certain that Mrs. Gardner's art will be returned.
How was that theft perpetrated?
In the early morning hours of March 18th, just as the city was quieting down from St. Patrick's Day celebrations, two thieves disguised as Boston police officers used a ruse to get into the employee entrance of the museum while there were only two guards on duty. In short order, they subdued the guards, handcuffed them, put them in the basement, and had their way with the museum for 81 minutes, taking 13 priceless works of art worth well over $500 million.
And do you have any sense what they've done with this art, if anything, or is it just sitting somewhere, do you think?
I believe it's just sitting somewhere, just like every other piece, and that's what led Tom and I to write this book. We did an enormous amount of research on, you know, coming into this saying, well, what happens to paintings like this? When everything from how the Rembrandts at the Gardner were stolen to where they go, who takes them, how they're stored, history shows a really strong pattern that they are stored well, they're recovered in good condition, and they are recovered, and they one day again hang on the walls of their home institution.
And then, of course, they have a little mystique that goes with them after they're recovered.
No question. I mean, in fact, occasionally a museum will take advantage of a theft to promote itself a little bit. There was a museum in Worcester, Massachusetts, is very happy to talk about, you know, the events surrounding a Rembrandt theft there back in 72. And Anthony is well aware of a episode on the West Coast. What have they done with that painting?
The De Young Museum, Tom?
Yeah.
Where that portrait of a rabbi was stolen from the De Young Museum in San Francisco. It was recovered a couple of decades after, and when it was recovered, it was found that the paint was separating from the canvas because of mold growth.
Huh.
And something I think was a really smart move, they put it on display in that way, in a special exhibition, to show the public what happens to this art when it's not cared for. The painting, Tom alluded to this type of thing, the painting was later found not to be a Rembrandt, which adds to this great story.
Right.
And it's now in storage, I believe, but it's just one of many incredible stories that we couldn't help but turn into a book.
Is there much theft or much of a market in more contemporary art?
If you have a piece of art and there's a high value attributed to it, it doesn't matter who the artist is. The thieves are looking at dollar figures. And in some cases, the thieves have no idea and just assume it's valuable. And they're stolen regularly, which adds to that $6 billion figure.
There has certainly been a wave over the past 10, 15 years or so of museum building in this country, and in fact around the world. Have new museums that have been constructed in the past 10, 20 years taken these facts into account and designed themselves with a little more inherent security?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, that's one of the problems older museums face, that usually the building was just chosen or built for its aesthetic without security in mind, which is understandable. But now, in fact, at the Gardner Museum, we're building a large extension to the building designed by Renzo Piano, and I'm working on that as we speak, and it's great because you can build it with security in mind. And our facility, for instance, will be even more secure because of this addition. It's really a great advance for museums.
Of course, it's more of a problem with some of the older museums that are more difficult to retrofit or to really take that into consideration.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's a case in 2000 in Stockholm, Sweden, where it was basically three armed men, two with automatic weapons, who burst into the museum shortly before it was about to close. And this is a giant, stately building right on the water, and it's a beautiful landmark. It's an extremely important museum for the National Museum, and but it's also not exactly the kind of building where you can have doors automatically slamming shut or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in a case like that, yes, they sit there somewhat vulnerable.
How does law enforcement view this? Obviously, some of these amounts of these crimes make it pretty serious, but does law enforcement take this really seriously?
In the United States, I'd say no. You could only point to one police department in the entire U.S. that has a full-time detective assigned to art theft, and that's Don Harisic at the LAPD, who's really a groundbreaker in the field. There used to be one at the NYPD. He passed away a few years ago and wasn't replaced. The FBI has an art theft team, and that's about a dozen agents who work on art theft as it arises in their area, or they lend guidance, but they're not a full-time go team, so to speak. If you go to France or Italy, you see large teams, and of course they have antiquities looting, so that's another need mm-hmm. for more police, but still we consider the scope of the crime in the United States, there definitely needs to be more attention paid to it.
Why hasn't there been, when you talk to law enforcement, whether it's the FBI or police in major cities like New York or Boston, why aren't they taking it more seriously?
Well, in terms of the FBI, I think they are. They have a program manager assigned to art theft. They take it very seriously. But I think one of the things Tom and I write about has to do with the public's perception of art. I think there's a large segment of the American population that looks at art crime as a crime against the rich, or, you know, it's not really their loss. They don't view it in the correct way, which is it's a crime against society. I mean, museums are there for just for that purpose, so the everyman can go and see these amazing works of art rather than just holding them in a private collection. So when an art theft happens, sometimes the public's slow to understand that this is really a crime against their people. I always think about the Gardner Museum theft, that there was a Vermeer, one of 36 Vermeers that was held in different places throughout history with no security in homes, that type of thing. And then it came to Boston, and we couldn't protect it adequately. Not the museum, the entire state, actually. So when you look at it in that sense, you see it's a crime against society.
What about the degree to which there is art theft perpetrated against individuals with impressive collections?
Half of all art theft in the United States occurs out of personal collections in people's homes. And it's often just like you would think. It's the contractor who entered the home and saw some pieces in a room that most people don't see, or an electrician who might know the security system if you have one at your house. And you see a lot of art stolen that way. So that's really a major problem in the U.S. I think that's something that needs serious addressing. I don't know of anybody who's working on the problem.
And is there a higher or lower recovery rate on those thefts from individuals?
Much lower, because the pieces are more easily traded on a black market. You don't typically see a 3-foot Rembrandt portrait stolen from someone's home. It's usually smaller pieces that are less identifiable, and then for that reason, easier to fence.
And Tom, how big is the black market in all of this stuff?
Well, as Anthony was indicating, for the smaller items, it's big enough. For example, if you steal gold or silver or some bejeweled item, even from a museum, you can break it down pretty fast or melt it down and get a cash value for it. And the same holds true for great pieces of art by name artists, but artists who haven't, you know, entered the pantheon like a Rembrandt or Renoir, Van Gogh. And so you have a black market there. But one of the things we do in the book is we point out that, you know, the idea that there's a Dr. No figure out there, such as the Sultan of Brunei or some wealthy criminal chieftain collecting these paintings for his own enjoyment, just doesn't stand up. It's a entertaining myth, but not one that we can find any proof for.
To what extent has the mythology of art theft, as we've seen it in literature and in movies, to what extent does that play a role in motivating art theft?
I think it plays a major role in motivating art theft, and I also think it has been detrimental to the search for stolen art. I can't tell you how many people I speak to, just about the case I'm investigating at the Gardner, believe wrongly that, oh, you know, these great pieces are clearly must be in the underground lair of some nefarious criminal mastermind, and they pay it no heed. They might not look for the pieces. They just put it out of their mind, figuring, how will you ever find this person who's in, like Tom said, the Sultan of Brunei or you know, some faraway land. So I think it's been very harmful, and it really colors the public's perception as to who might have stolen the piece, so therefore people might not be thinking of the common criminal they know.
Mm-hmm.
Who fits the perfect MO for the theft that occurred in the newspapers.
Is there a profile that either of you have seen over the years in terms of the people that do steal this stuff?
Low-level criminal, low- to mid-level criminal, someone with an incredible lack of foresight when you're talking about masterpieces because they can never fence them. People who have arrest records already, they've robbed armored cars or gas stations or home invasions, those type of crimes. It's not, the one thing Tom and I make clear in the book is that this is not Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible rappelling down a wall and evading intricate motion detection systems. These are common criminals.
Anthony Amore, Tom Mashberg, the book is Stealing Rembrandts. Tom, Anthony, I thank you both so much for spending time with us today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.